So the fortunes of Fur Buyer's Son were up and down, and then finally at about 3 in the morning, O'Connell was the big winner, and he declared that he had to meet an unavoidable commitment. That is, he had promised his wife that he would be home at 3, so it was the hour of 3, he must leave the game. With him, he took $7,500 worth of what was left of the $9,500 fur buying stake, and Perry assured him that he should come back after due rest, and that there was plenty of resource left in the fur buying pot, and that he'd be welcome into the game later on in the morning. So in a matter of 8 or 10 minutes, I heard an aircraft start up. As I mentioned, there's a storm in progress, obscured visibility, heavy snow, and sure enough, was an aircraft, and the engine warmed up, and finally there was a roar, and the aircraft disappeared into the night. Needless to say, it was O'Connell, and he disappeared, aimed at the village of No Attack. And he disappeared for good reason, too. He not only took $7,000 of the fur buying stake, but a considerable amount of change from some of the non-resident polar bear hunters. And I later learned that he had paid off one of his aircraft and his house, for which the bank was about to foreclose. The storm raged throughout the next day, and O'Connell was nowhere to be seen. He was cooling his heels, and he had made it through to the village of No Attack, and that was where he stayed. He took the resource with him and made sure that his banker got the results, the full revenue of that poker game. These are a series of answers to questions. Go ahead.
Okay, Tom, what kind of plane
did you use? Well, I used a Super Cub because of the altitude and because of the nature of the ice. You're restricted to certain areas for certain aircraft. I have landed the Cessna 6-passenger type aircraft up to the 12,500 foot levels under given conditions. These conditions are density altitude, that is, where the cool of the morning give you a favorable advantage over the indicated altitude due to the thickness of the air. Also, the confines of where you land determines what type of aircraft you use. Now, at the 14,300 foot level that we used in the big rescue of 1960, this is the highest landing area any fixed-wing aircraft ever landed on McKinley. I discovered the place in the calamity of 1960, when three tragedies took place from 17,000 to 15,000 feet almost simultaneously. There's a number of considerations of weight. At that elevation, a Super Cub, which weighs only 1,000 pounds, the 150 horsepower model, with special retractable skis and special radio gear, will go about 1150. It takes good the concentrated efforts of six good men to manhandle this aircraft while running with someone at the controls in certain types of snow conditions at the 14,300 foot elevation. In other words, in spite of the fact that we have a new turbo double supercharged 6-passenger Cessna, I would hesitate to take this heavy aircraft that has an empty weight of nearly a ton into this area, because It's a confined area with a 2,200-foot no overrun takeoff, and that is all on about a 15% grade. The aircraft, in spite of the fact that it delivers sea level horsepower at 14,000 feet, would not be suitable for that particular area because of the short takeoff run. You would have no time to change your mind in an event of an aborted takeoff. For areas with greater overrun possibilities, and also the surface of the area makes a lot of difference. You have to use discretion because the plan is not to decorate the scenery with your valuable airplanes. Go ahead. I never knew what the wager amount was for. There was a considerable sum of money wagered, but also there was a considerable amount of pride involved, because Ricardo Cousin had climbed all of the mountains of the world, all of the major mountains, including some of the tough Himalayas, and was recognized as world authority on climbing. Well, I would say it was 60% reputation and 40% money.
The morning that you left, 3 o'clock, where we arrived there at 2 o'clock, we had a body. Did you do a lot of flying the night before? Did you get to sleep and all that type of stuff?
Well, I'm afraid I didn't. I was up till about midnight, and this is usually the way it goes in the press of the summer activities. Well, it's a organization to teach mountaineering and outdoor activities to the younger generation. And they have a refined program. There are several programs very similar. One of them is Outbound, one of them is Lifebound, where they teach the art of rope and ice and rock climbing and mountaineering and best procedures, survival, how to take care of yourself away from the jungle of civilization in the great outdoors. No, it's not sponsored. It's privately funded, and they have a lot of clients. Well, if I hadn't hung the rear of the skis, the plane would have went in backwards. Well, some of these holes are several hundred feet deep. Well, in the case of Dr. Lathrop's son, who I recovered below Windy Corner at about 12,000 feet, I landed successfully in a no-wind condition. By the time it took 2 hours, that is, to get the son with a frozen foot to the plane, the tremendous winds came up, and it was a downwind condition, no possible chance of taking off, and so what we did was buried snowshoes deep in the snow, 10 feet deep, and dead man the wings to the snowshoes. And then as the storm progressed throughout the night and the next day, it snowed 12 feet deep. And as I mentioned once before to you, there's a Hans Moser of Canada happened along with his ski team of eight, and he recorded in beautiful color movie the whole operation of the plane being snowed over level when the storm did break, and the problems. I made 5 consecutive takeoffs before I was able to get airborne with Dr. Lathrop's son. I could go into that. That's quite a tale at a later time. He was down in Elmendorf for Fort Rich area.
What kind of a plane was made?
Well, I think it was military King Air version.
Where was Johnson living at the time he seemed up the bridge?
Oh, he had a cabin on the south side of McKinley, about 20 miles north of Talkeetna. Oh, well, you mean for the winter climb or for the Sanford? Oh, well, yeah, he was in the process of building a cabin, which is about 18 miles north of Talkeetna up toward the base of McKinley. He later finished the cabin. It's a fine place.
Is Rex Post any relation to the post that the lake was named after?
I don't think any relation there.
This is probably a pretty stupid question, but why couldn't a helicopter go to the wreck and correct it?
Well, due to the sheerness of the terrain, they tried the strategy of landing on top at 14,000 or hovering and letting the cold weather test experts that they had come down a rope to the very top, but they by 8/10 people coming down the rope ladder suffered frostbite before they set foot on top of the mountain due to the rotor blast. He wasn't the manager. O'Connell was just one of the boys in the game. He didn't manage the Kotzebue store at all. We were in the Rotman Hotel, which is a hotel at Kotzebue, in room 5, which had just been constructed at that time. And O'Connell was just one of the players. Either he had a streak of unconscious luck or I exercised some control we couldn't detect. But the thing was, he did get away with the money. He did pay off his house and his aircraft, for which the last note was long overdue. Well, this was down in Anchorage at Carr's store, not Kotzebue.
Okay,
see, we're leaving from Anchorage. They don't have patrolmen up in Kotzebue.
That's what I thought. So
yeah, well, see, we departed Anchorage.
Do you think it just got accidentally shoved up to
the... Oh, it was a pure accident. It was just kicked off to one side. Nobody, right. If you have any discrepancies like that, let's catch them now. Because this is just purely accidental. The problem, Perry set the satchel down on the floor. Somebody kicked it about 30 feet. It wound up underneath the these old push carts they used to have down there. And it was purely accidental. Number one, that he left it there. Number two, that it got kicked out of sight. Number three, that nobody found it.
What kind of a strip did the landing trip at Ruby have
that time? Well, we landed at Ruby on the ice of the river. The Ruby Strip is up on a hill a mile and a half from town. We wouldn't land there. We'd land down by the village.
What kind of a plane did you fly in?
Well, I used Cessnas, and I used, on this particular one, a Super Cub. This is the answer to some questions listed as a biographical account. In general, it says, where were you born and raised? I was born in Mount Morrison, Colorado, raised in Wyoming on the edge of the Red Desert, and we rode horses 5 miles to school. At an old schoolhouse near Lander, Wyoming. Now, this area of Wyoming was great game country at one time. Many thousands and thousands of buffaloes lived there. It's a great elk, a great small game country. Many Indian tribes lived there. The Shoshones and the Arapahoes and the Crows and the Blackfoots were all Indian tribes that lived in this area. Even in plowing the fields, the old plow would turn up many arrowheads of various types. Some of the arrowheads were war spearheads. Some of the arrowheads were made of flint, some of slate, some of agate. Some of the spearheads were maybe 8-10 inches in length, and had razor edges even at this late date. At any rate, well preserved. As I say, the reason you could find the arrowheads was because of this area of Wyoming was one of the great game areas of the West. there's also the small game arrowheads were of a lesser size. They were used for shooting birds and rabbits and that type of small game. And then I went to a school in Lander there. It's sort of central Wyoming. It's surrounded by the Wind River and the Poposia Mountains, a very spectacular part of Wyoming near Jackson, where you have the high mountains of Jackson, Wyoming. Also, not too far from Dunor and Du Bois, a great cattle country of Wyoming. During high school in Wyoming, at the age of 13, I was able to acquire a job at a place near Du Bois, Wyoming, where the Wyoming Pine Timber Company was much in evidence. They used this big Wind River to float thousands of railroad ties downriver to a pickling plant located several hundred miles downstream, a small town called Riverton, Wyoming. My job was to help in the kitchen with the old Dutch oven cooking system. That would be a Dutch oven, of course, is a large iron pot with a heavy lipped rim, and you baked the bread and made roasts and various cobblers and things for the hungry tie drivers. My job was to wrestle these big Dutch ovens around and to clean them and to help start the fires in each new camp that we set up. The chief cook's name was Solom, an old Norwegian who was a master at the art of outdoor cooking. As I recall, there was about 75 tie drivers, and these were very rugged types, Norwegians, Finns, and Irishmen, and a sprinkling of Skookum, other outdoor people that would run the tie jams and to expedite the movement of thousands and thousands of carloads of ties down this big river into the pickling plant. My job continued through 38, the summer of 38, where I was able to acquire a small stake. Two companions and I departed after this. All the ties had arrived at the tie plant at Riverton, and we had recovered all these railroad tie fixtures for the tie company into the pickling plant and onto the conveyors. Two friends and I departed Riverton in an old beat-up Model A Ford and headed for Alaska via a direct route through Idaho and through Oregon. And we rebuilt the old Ford about six times en route, but we finally arrived at Pier 1, Seattle, just in time to see the only boat of the week, the steamship Yukon, depart for Alaska. My two friends elected to return to the Oregon peach orchards, where they would not only admire peaches, but also pick a few. I elected to stay at the YMCA and wait 1 week and not take a chance on missing the next boat. So when the next boat went northbound, I was on it. And this began my adventure to Alaska. We came up the inside passage, crossed the Gulf of Alaska, changed to a train and soared. My first job in Anchorage was driving a milk wagon for an old dairy farm located in Anchorage. My main job at the dairy farm was in the bottling department, where we worked from 4 in the morning until 11 at night, with a few delivery trips in between. And after 6 weeks at this job, which was almost a record for the plant, that is to say, most people wouldn't stand that schedule, but I was desperate, and since I had a job, and since the jobs were so few, I elected to stay as long as I could at the plant. So one day on the milk route, I nearly ran over someone who looked familiar, and it was a sailor I'd met in Juneau at an 8-hour stop at Juneau. And he said, "How much money do you have?" I said, "I think I have $12 and some cents." And he said, "You know, we ought to go north." So we went down to the railroad depot to find out how far $12 would go. And this is primarily how I wound up in Talkeetna. It was a tremendous place at that time. There were about 50 active mines in the area. The miners were just coming in. We're now in the month of October 1938. And big dog teams were tethered around the old miners' buildings. Also, a considerable native village lived on the riverbank. And in the low overcast, the smell of wood smoke and salmon and moose jerky and booze fumes put a real atmosphere to the village of Talkeetna. As I say, the miners were coming in, and most of them were quite successful in the gold mines. To the west of Talkeetna, 50 miles to the Cache Creek and about 65 miles into the Fairview. And the great social season of the miners usually started when they all arrived from their mining operations in the hills, that is the gold recovery at the various small mines. Some of the more fortunate miners would resolve to go back to Ireland or Norway or Sweden or Germany. And there were many sand traps en route. The first one was Talkeetna itself. First they had to break away, make a clean breakaway from Talkeetna. The next big pitfall was Anchorage. A little more complicated process to make a clean breakaway from all of the social activities of the Anchorage area, all of the old mining friends and all of the old fishing acquaintances and people that the miners had known for years. A few made the Anchorage breakaway and headed out on the old Alaska steamship line en route to Seattle. Now, Seattle presented a formidable pitfall within itself. many bright lights there, many ways for an old miner with a poke full of gold to go astray in Seattle. On rare occasions, one or more of the old miners would make it through the port of Seattle and actually get back into the old country to visit old acquaintances. Usually the way it went, though, was that if they got by Talkeetna, they'd get short-stopped somewhere between Anchorage and Seattle and probably send a letter back to some of their friends for enough money to get back steerage on the steamboat so they could start all over again. But this was a pattern of the old-time miners, and it was repeated many, many times throughout the various cities of Alaska. And it's unfortunate, but this is the way it worked. If someone got their hands on some resource, it was generally such a shock to their system that they went ape when they got to the bright lights. There you go. There was a considerable amount of activity in October 1938, as I mentioned, in this small village of Talkeetna. He had to come hither of an old Alaska atmosphere. First, I had to find some gainful employment here that I might better my cupboard. So, I mentioned this to the commissioner, that we were game, this sailor and I, to hire out as woodcutters, which we did, and we accomplished a considerable pile of wood before the temperature dropped in December to about 35 below zero, at which time you couldn't make much headway cutting frozen birch and spruce. So I became acquainted with one of the old-time owners of one of the local stores. Her name was Belle McDonald. She was a fine old lady, and she had made a fortune in Alaska, but had given it all away in grubstakes to the various miners, who very seldom were able to pay back the favor in money or time. However, she made the note that she had dearly loved a moose. Some moose meat, that is. And moose had been scarce that winter, and so I resolved, if possible, to shoot a moose for the store owner. And now the season had long passed, the active legal moose season. Early one morning, I heard a strange noise outside my old frosted cabin, and I peered out through a crack in the logs, and I saw a huge moose standing by the front of the door, and I reached stealthily back around the corner for my small caliber 250 Savage rifle, and with a great amount of reservations, I took one shot at the moose, and he fell like he'd come out of a coal chute, right? The shot was a lucky one, right square between his eyes. I was able to barter some of this moose meat for groceries. Very soon thereafter, the commissioner heard that I'd shot a moose. And I also was quite wary, since he was a commissioner, of what the outcome of my shooting a moose out of season and trading it for groceries would be. So I took him a part of the liver, which he accepted quite gratefully. And thereafter, due to the fact that the meat was short in town, fresh meat, and the high cost of shipped-in boat meat, I become a moose hunter. I clobbered two more moose, both out of season, both traded for groceries, and in both cases, dutifully took the commissioner some of the liver and some of the better tenderloin steak cuts. And so began my sojourn in the great village of Talkeetna. The following month, an old-timer had a disastrous cabin fire. He barely escaped with his life. My companion, the sailor, had departed for more friendly climates to the south, so I invited the old-timer to come share my cabin, my frosty cabin, which had been loaned to me by an old-timer in the area. Thompson was the miner's name whose cabin burned down, and he spent great lengths telling me how to properly skin out various animals, such as beaver. And the revenue for beaver was at the $25 mark, which was a considerable sum of money at that time. So I continuing with the Point Hope polar bear tale. The senator, you recall, had pointed the Weatherby hair trigger gun down, accidentally bumped it in an effort to turn the safety to the off position. There was a tremendous explosion. The cockpit was filled with cordite, and we nearly deafened ourselves in the explosion. And senator said, "Oh my God, I shot my left foot off." So I said, "Well, let's get out and look at it." As I explained, I had special sealskin mukluks made for the whole party and myself, of large size, so that one might wear caribou socks and insoles within the sealskin muckluck. At any rate, these were quite large mukluks. The senator was a large man. He took a size 14 set of muklucks. So I helped him out of the plane, and he sat on a frozen whale rib in the sand there, and peeled off the sealskin muckluck. The Weatherby 200-grain slug had just sliced down the back of the muckluck, and so we opened the muckluck up, slid it off his foot. The next in line was a sliced set of caribou socks. Still no blood. And likewise, it was ripped down from the back. We just slid it off the front of the senator's foot. He says, "Oh," he says, "my foot is sure numb." Well, I said, "I don't see any blood." Anyway, we got down to three sets of wool socks and still no blood, but there was a big welt, concussion welt down the back of the senator's Achilles heel, down the back of his leg. So in due time, we got the senator into another set of mucklucks, and we continued along on the polar bear hunt. I might mention that as a storm subsides, it usually snows. The sun usually comes out for 2 or 3 hours, and the whole North Sea is a beautiful area with a tremendous amount of natural sea life. That would be the various seals, the ugruks, and occasionally you see a whale of various types. There's many types of whales. There's a black whale, and there's a beluga whale, and even in the month of June, the killer whales come in from the Japanese current and destroy the calves of the beluga whale and the various gray whales and the other species. I think I might while we're in the North Coast area, relate a typical story of a fur buying expedition. Usually some of the prominent fur buyers of Alaska would engage various pilots with their aircraft to fly to the interior areas, and in specific the North Coast, to buy the beautiful white fox, the polar bear hides, the various other types of fur, the marten, and the wolverine, and the other fine furs of the North Coast. And usually this would take place between the 1st and the 6th day of January on each fresh new year. I want to point out that the daylight is extremely short at this time of the year, and that a familiarity of the area and a properly working aircraft with a good automatic direction finder is a big help in negotiating the short daylight and the perennial storms that crash into the North Coast and interior Alaska at this time of the year, that is, in the first part of January. So it was at the 5th of January in about 1955 that I was engaged to take the son of one of the prominent fur buyers of Alaska, who also has spent 40 years in the fur manufacturing business, on a North Coast run to Point Barrow to replenish their supply of the various fine, lush furs of the far north. So, normally, all transactions are cash. This means that you have to start out with a considerable amount of cash, which you will determine shortly. You must be watched very closely. The old fur buyer entrusted his eldest son with a huge satchel, an old beat-up doctor's satchel, full of ready cash for the fur buying expedition, probably about $40,000. This was a late afternoon departure. First, we had several things to complete. One is that always you carry plenty of emergency gear and plenty of food. You take along items such as milk and oranges, which if froze can be unfrozen and still be palatable. Also, the various types of bolognese and cheeses and that type of thing that you can snack on while flying the hundreds of miles stretches between waypoints and interior and up on the North Coast sections. So we were engaged at this particular time, late in the afternoon, at an old market in the Anchorage area, buying up food for our North Coast flight. Our plan was to fly, since the night was about 30 below and clear and free of ice fog, no forecasted ice fog in the areas, over the Alaska Range and land at the village of Ruby, which was our first stop. And they knew that we were en route to previous correspondence of a month or so earlier. And so all the trappers of the area would gather at the waypoints and await arrival, where we would trade them $100 bills for their fine furs. As I say, Ruby is located about 275 miles west of Anchorage over the Alaska Range. Now, the fur buyer's son, we'll call him Perry, said to me, "Now, you take care of the satchel and I'll help with the groceries." I said, "No, you take care of the satchel and I'll take care of the groceries." So we caught a cab finally out to the plane. It was about 10:30 at night, a beautiful moonlight night, as I mentioned, and loaded all our supplies into the plane. And Perry said, "Hey, where's the satchel?" I said, "Don't tell me your troubles. I brought the groceries out. You are taking care of the satchel." So, of course, the satchel referred to the $40,000 in the doctor's case which was our Furbrang cash stake for the North Coast run. And so we got a hold of another cab, rushed back to the old market, and beat on the door. The market was closed. Very shortly, two patrol cars showed up and started to load us up and head us towards the local city jail. And we finally got the attention of a very harried manager of the store, who was peeking around the corner, and he said, "Please let us look inside. We've left a big satchel of money." And the cop said, "Yeah, yeah, get into the paddy wagon. We hear this all the time." And we said, "No, no, this is a true story. We inadvertently left our fur buying stake in the market here, and we beat on the door, and apparently they thought we were breaking in, so they called the paddy wagons." Well, anyway, the cops took his nightstick and rapped on the door a couple of times, and in the meanwhile, we were securely held by several of the local police types, and the owner came, or the manager, opened the door and said, "Yes, yes, these are the ones that were trying to break in." And the cop said, "Yes, yes," and they claimed that they left a big satchel with $40,000 here in the market, and could we have a look around? And the manager says, "Oh, yes, indeed, yes, indeed. You can look around, but I doubt that you'll find any such thing as a satchel with $40,000 in it." So we looked around, sure enough, no satchel. And as we'd been at the counter, they had these old-fashioned roll-around buggies, some of the old models, and they'd been stacked up and moved around, and I looked as we were being led out, and I say, "Hey, there's a satchel underneath about 30 feet from the counter where we'd left it." And Perry rushed over, opened the satchel, and sure enough, it was stuffed full of various denominations of bills, and the patrolmen, policemen were unbelievable that it should actually be full of money, and they examined the money. They called up Perry's father, the furrier, and verified that this was a true situation, and then they personally escorted us out for about a 11:30, almost a midnight takeoff. And they saw us into the air, and they were still parked there. As I looked back, as we disappeared in the distance, I still see the patrol car there with its blinking light sitting on the field. Well, at any rate, we pulled into Ruby on the Yukon about 3:30 in the morning, and got the plane tied down, and I noticed a light in the old Olson Roadhouse. And so we made our way up the bank to the old roadhouse and engaged in a big pangingi game, which you play with seven decks of cards, was all the miners of the area and all the luminaries and the owner of the Olson Roadhouse. So Perry, being the gambler type, immediately joined forces, and he changed the name of the game to a poker game. And about 9 o'clock the next morning, we departed Ruby with a considerable amount of the Ruby funds from the pangingi game and the poker game that later developed. And we continued on up the coast, and we finally made all the stops, including the various villages and outlying areas, Shishmaref and Kotzebue and Kivalina and Point Hope, and we finally made our way to Wainwright. Now, this is a Dew Line site, and at that time, the Dew Line was in Great Commission, that is, the early warning Dew Line site was protecting the Northern Hemisphere, and it was staffed and manned by technicians who had nothing to do but gamble away their lucrative $2,000-$3,000 a month paychecks in a fine and fancy mess hall, and they were served gourmet food and four or five kinds of meat for lunch, and they were taken care of in all areas except one. They had no company, and in spite of the fine surroundings, they were doing a drudge job at high pay. So that's what held most of the Dewline talent there on these early warning sites. At any rate, Wainwright was such a sight. So we pulled in there late, about 1:30 in the afternoon, as I recall, and they had two village chiefs in some villages, including Wainwright. In other words, before a big monetary fur deal took place, they must get the approval of both village chiefs. Now, one village chief was on a caribou hunting expedition, and the other was in town. He was agreeable to the figures offered for a warehouse full of beautiful, luxuriant white fox, polar bear hides, wolverine, and other fine furs of the north. However, he couldn't sell because of the second chief, who had to put his okay for the final sale. Therefore, it necessitated staying overnight. We stayed overnight at the Dewline site, which is adjacent to the village of Wainwright. And about 1 o'clock or thereabouts the next day, the second village chief pulled into town on his dog sled, and he okayed the final sale of this warehouse full of beautiful fur for cash. So the deal was all put together, and the fur was to be shipped via parcel post, because you get the parcel post rate, and there's no mail moves out of the North Coast unless it's by air. In other words, they shipped several tons of fur and seal hides, which are quite weighty, at the parcel post rate airmail, which was a neat way to move a tremendous amount of weight at a nominal cost. Well, this put us into the 2:30, 3:30 time area, and already the sun had long gone down. There was purple twilight. The whiteout shifted in all quadrants. Northern lights were starting out, and Perry insisted we push on to Point Barrow. And he was so insistent. Well, the reason he may have been insistent was that his fortunes at poker were great at the Dewline site, and he didn't necessarily want to duplicate any effort that he put forth the night that we were at the Dewline site. Besides, there was a great urgency to get to Barrow. So he just wouldn't take no for an answer. So I said okay to myself. All right, Perry, we'll go. So at 3:30, with the shifting whiteouts and the northern light shining to the southeast and a stiff northeast wind, which is the worst kind for that area, we departed, and my plan was to fly 10 minutes on a north-northwesterly heading, do a 180-degree turn, and come back and land at Wainwright and declare that the conditions didn't warrant proceeding to Barrow. This was my no for an answer. Well, we proceeded 10 minutes on a northwest heading. And I might add that the compass is just not too reliable that far north. The variation and the various magnetic load fields affect the compass adversely. So I did a 180-degree turn, came back on a reciprocal heading, and would you believe, I couldn't find Wainwright. And it rattled my cage considerably, because we were in trouble. It was 35 below zero, a 15-mile-an-hour wind with a chill factor of 50 below zero, about, and I just unable to find Wainwright. So I reversed my course, headed back to the northwest, and headed for Barrow. When it became apparent, hopeless, that I could not find Wainwright. We flew for about 45 minutes, And the whiteouts and the shifting winds began to kick up ground snow, and they mingled together, and it was impossible to see very far ahead or very much. So I held a compass heading, held my altitude, and flew and flew, and all of a sudden, from left to right, we saw a flash of something. And I say, "Did you see that, Perry?" He says, "Yeah, was that a fox?" I says, "Yep, you know something?" And all this time I was easing the plane up in the air an inch at a time, because what had happened was we were flying underneath a 60-foot pressure ridge. A fox ran across, quartering left to right, and disappeared over our right wing, over the top of the pressure ridge. So immediately I knew we were flying the North Coast pressure ridge between the shoreline and the Chukchi Arctic Ocean. And I pulled up about 60 feet in the air and got on top of the pressure ridge, which I followed for about another 18 minutes. And at this point, the pressure ridge disappeared completely in the whiteout. So I held the heading and flew and centered the turn and bank and the gyro and continued. And I guessed that I must be in the lagoons about now, about 100 miles north of, 125 miles north of Wainwright. And suddenly I saw a faint fringe, and I says, "Uh-oh, we're in the lagoons, all right." But one thing I knew about the lagoons, it was not too uneven, and you might land there. And almost while I lost the first willow line, I saw something else. It looked like a herd of caribou moving, so I just throttled the airplane back and landed, and nearly ran over an old Eskimo and 12 dogs. And he looked in, and I looked out, and he says, "Where you go?" I say, "Where you go?" He say, "I head for Rock House." I say, "Tell you what, I'll give you a case of fresh milk if you lead us to your rock house." See, this is a desperate situation. It's a chill factor of 50 below zero. To heat an engine in 50 below is almost impossible. The rising wind could blow the plane away if you landed. If you tied the airplane down, you could not possibly get it started again, although I had two heating unit possibilities with me. And naturally, I was overjoyed to see the old Eskimo and his 12 dogs. So he took the case of frozen milk aboard and started out slowly. And I followed him, and his pace increased, and he went faster and faster until he was doing 25 miles an hour, and I was taxiing 25 miles an hour. And suddenly I ran into the rough, and the plane caromed into the air, and I thought for a minute I would knock off a landing gear. I finally got in front of the dog team and said, "Wait, you go too fast." He said, "It's late, late night. I got to get to Rock House." I say, "Which way is Wainwright?" He said, "Wainwright," like he never heard of the place before. He said, "That way." And he pointed the opposite way that I thought Wainwright should be. I say, "Which way, Point Barrel?" He say, "That way," and pointed some other direction. And we're really up against it here. We can't follow him. He goes too fast. If we tie the airplane down, we'll never get it started again if we have a cold spell for 2 weeks. So I say, "How long have you lived here?" He say, "I live here 69 years. I say, "Which way is Wainwright?" And this time I take a peek at the compass and set the gyro against the compass. And I say, "How many miles?" He say, "Wainwright, 67 miles that way." I set the gyro, read the compass. I say, "Okay, we're going back to Wainwright. In case anybody looking for us, you tell them we go back towards Wainwright." What had happened was, I went north possibly 135 miles, went south maybe 40 miles, which left us 68 miles or 67 miles from Wainwright, which is south-southeast, following the meandering shoreline and the pressure ridge of the ice and also the willow fringe of the coast and the lagoons up in the Wiley Post crash area. Well, at any rate, I glued the gyro and the compass together, and I flew for about 40 minutes. And out of the whiteout appeared a bunch of lights. Wainwright. And Perry was overjoyed to stay at Wainwright that evening, what was left of the night. So the plane we tied down beneath the city light planet, Wainwright. We determined that it would cost $12 an hour to run the light plant from midnight till 8 in the morning, since they shut the light plant down. So we bargained to pay $12 an hour for 8 hours, $96, for the privilege of hooking up 5 200-watt light bulbs furnished by the light plant so that the plane would be hot so we could continue to point barrel in the morning. And they agreed to run the light plant. So at 8 o'clock in the morning, we paid the $96 to the operator of the light plant. The airplane was nice, the engine was nice and warm. It started very easily. And I taxied out, but discovered I couldn't taxi. And I got out, I looked at the tail spring hookup, and lo and behold, to my amazement, somebody had removed the tail spring balance springs from the rear end of the airplane. Later, I learned that they're a great favorite, these springs are, for the return pressure dog sled hookup, where you step on a brake that has a big claw that jams into the ice to slow your dog sled. So, any rate, I was not too happy about losing my tail springs, so I went to the store and I acquired some screen door type return springs, which I put together in such a manner as to at least be able to taxi the aircraft. Well, we proceeded to barrel, and there we bought another warehouse full of fur, and it all went well until the return trip at Kotzebue. And there we met near financial disaster with what was left of the $40,000 fur buying stake. We arrived at Kotzebue late in the storm one afternoon there. This puts us into about the 7th or 8th of March. Just got in under the wire into Kotzebue southbound. We have about $9,500 left out of the $40,000 cash. And at the Rotman Hotel, which was then a new structure, raged a 4-5-6 game. And in room 5, it was obvious that there was a game in progress. The hooping and shouting and various commotion caused by the 4-5-6 players. So Perry, being the gambler that he was, decided to join the fun and see if he could make a few bills on the deal. So in a short while, Perry got command of the 4-5-6 game. In an hour and a half, he had quite a bit of the loose money of the game. Now there was some polar bear hunters, some guides, and some of the itinerants in the Kotzebue area in this game, and they one by one dropped by the wayside till finally there was 4 players left there, and they were splashing the dice off a bed against the side wall of the Rotman Hotel. And as I say, Perry pretty well cornered the resource, and then one of the players returned with a small check from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, And he brought with him three poker decks. And they were apparently new decks. They were the bicycle, unmarked type, hopefully. And the 4-5-6 game degenerated into a poker game. And this suited Perry to no end because poker was one of his better games. Now, he already had most of the resource out of the 4-5-6 game I want to mention. Poker party shaped up, and soon it was apparent that possibly, in view of the fact the stakes were considerably smaller than the 4-5-6 game, Perry was holding his own and winning a few pots, but I noticed that he usually win the small ones. And that one of the players, O'Connell, would sometimes tap off the big ones. And I looked the cards over, and they were true bicycle cards. We changed decks. We used all three decks. And then I dropped out, and I became bookkeeper for Perry. And the fortunes of the poker game were not in Perry's favor. Finally, I went down to $6,000. At this point, Perry changed his strategy. He wanted to double his bets, which he did. In a stud game, you can, on a no-limit game, double your bets. You can triple them.